Social Security and Medicare aren't getting any younger.
How long can Washington keep delaying a fix for the country's big entitlement programs?
From APM, American Public Media, I'm Jeremy Hobson in Los Angeles.
And I'm David Brancaccio in New York. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Tuesday, April the 24th.
Coming up, income inequality in New York.
Turning right on Wall Street when it comes to political donations.
And a caviar eating contest where the real prize is the caviar you have to devour.
All right, those stories and more coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
We'll start with a concerning report from the trustees who oversee the nation's two largest entitlement programs. The Social Security Trust Fund, they say, will run out of money 3 years earlier than previously thought in 2033. As for Medicare, that's still on track to run out of cash in 2024. Olivia Mitchell is executive director of the Pension Research Council at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. She joins us now from Philadelphia. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, how concerning is this report for someone like you who follows this issue very closely?
Well, it's concerning only in the sense that this underscores the gravity of the problem that we face. The last time something serious was done to support Social Security was in 1983.
Yeah.
And we're long past due, and it's time to get started.
Well, some of the proposals to shore up these programs are things like raising the age of eligibility again, cutting benefits. How soon would that kind of thing have to happen to keep these programs solvent?
If you take a narrow view, what you understand is that there's a trust fund, which is supposed to be the piggy bank, whereby if the funds run short, the Social Security Administration can go and claim these bonds. But if you take the broad view, which I do take, you have to understand that the money actually has been spent. And so what it means is we'll either have to raise taxes or cut expenditures or issue more debt to be able to pay the scheduled benefits.
Now, you seem rather calm about all of this. Do you sort of assume that eventually lawmakers will just do what has to be done?
I think if lawmakers don't raise revenue somehow, benefits will have to be cut by about a third. And for many people who rely on Social Security heavily, this will be a big challenge.
Olivia Mitchell is executive director of the Pension Research Council at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Turns out, the flow of people moving between Mexico and the U.S. is close to zero right now. That surprising new data today comes from the nonpartisan Pew Hispanic Center. By comparison, over the last four decades, an estimated 12 million Mexicans came to the U.S. To understand the reversal, we turn to Douglas Massey, co-director of the Mexican Migration Project at Princeton and the University of Guadalajara. Professor Massey, good morning.
Good morning.
What is your sense about some of the causes of this, what looks like a sea change in migration pattern?
Well, as usual, there are changes on both sides of the border. In the United States, there, of course, was the economic collapse in 2008, which really hammered some of the main areas of job growth and labor demand for Mexican immigrants. On the Mexican side, the economy isn't doing that badly. And the Mexican birth rate over the past three decades has fallen dramatically, and that means that right now the rate of labor force growth in Mexico is slowing. So all in all, we really see pretty much an end to a 60-year boom in Mexico-U.S. migration.
Now, you haven't mentioned greater border enforcement as a possibility here. Are you discounting that?
Well, all the studies that I've done basically show that the militarization of the border that we undertook for the past two decades had the perverse effect of reducing rates of return migration back to Mexico, which is why the Mexican undocumented population grew so rapidly in the 80s and early part of the 2000s. Basically, immigration is driven by demand in the U.S., by the opportunities for legal entry on the U.S. side, and by economic conditions and the size of the labor force growth in Mexico. And those factors have all changed.
Well, Douglas Massey, co-director of the Mexican Migration Project at Princeton, thank you very much.
Thank you.
U.S. home prices stayed basically flat in February, according to the S&P Case-Shiller Index. Without adjusting for seasonal fluctuations, prices actually dropped 0.8% to reach the lowest level since 2002. And that's where we'll start now with Julie Niemann, analyst at Smith Moore & Company. She's with us, as always, from St. Louis. Good morning.
Morning, Jeremy.
Well, Julie, I keep thinking when this monthly report comes out that eventually I'm going to see some good news that home prices actually started to rebound. When's that going to happen?
Well, February was ugly, but nobody moves unless you have to. You've got high inventory, though, right now. More foreclosures and homeowners who bought from 2005 on are underwater. But why? The banks are finally moving their inventory into the market now, and that's why you're seeing distressed prices even further. It looks like a used car lot at a lot of the banks, and that puts pressure on prices, and they're finally doing quick sales. So the good news, spring-summer selling season is here. Interest rates are still staying very low. Jobs market is improving. Confidence isn't getting too much worse, and new housing construction is improving. So I think we're at the bottoming process. Now, it's not all areas. Chicago, Atlanta are still really in the ditch, but the Sand States, that's where the bargain buying is really looking better. Arizona, Nevada, Florida, California. So the bottom line is, price it right, and there's a buyer out there.
All right, Julie, well, quickly, let's switch gears. I just want to get your thoughts on Apple, which is going to report its earnings later today. A lot of people think that the tech bubble may be bursting. What do you think?
Well, it's a tech as entertainment bubble. You're not seeing this big correction in Microsoft, Intel, Oracle. You're getting a lot of suspicion on things like the Facebook IPO. They did an amended filing.
Right.
You had Groupon, total disaster. Accounting controls at Groupon were exposed. But you have to remember, every company that's been a U.S. darling on the cover of every magazine but the Rolling Stone always has hype pushing the price. And when a fearless leader leaves, like Jack Welch at GE, Steve Jobs at Apple, investors want another rock star. There's not one coming. You have to have, it was also a one-space kind of thing. You must have this in your portfolio, like Amazon. Well, as soon as the institutional investors start seeing that there are other alternatives, and competition always produces alternatives, the prices get knocked down. So I'd argue that you're seeing a correction in entertainment and technology combination.
Julie Niemann, analyst with Smith Moore & Company, thanks as always.
You bet.
Have you ever thought about pocketing a filet steak when you were in the supermarket? In the UK, meat theft is on the rise, and it's not just hungry individuals. We're talking fully fledged organized crime gangs. And it doesn't stop at supermarket meat. In today's Midday Extra, here's the BBC's Sarah Stolarz with more.
The price of steak and lamb has shot up in the UK recently. And as a result, theft of fresh meat jumped close to 10% last year, according to the UK Centre for Retail Research. And it isn't just hungry shoppers lifting a lamb shank here and there. Signs are pointing to organised crime. Large quantities of the same product are being stolen at the same time. In an effort to tackle the growing problem, UK supermarkets have started slapping security tags on chicken legs and even minced meat. Think those anti-theft devices usually reserved for alcohol bottles or high-priced clothing. Plus, some criminals are going even farther, cutting out the middleman and heading straight to the farm to make the theft. Tim Price is from rural insurer NFU Mutual.
They're being very quickly slaughtered, butchered, and then sold on as meat to small-scale retailers or somehow larger retailers.
It is estimated that 67,000 sheep could have been stolen last year, costing farmers more than $8 million. As food prices continue to soar, some farmers are putting up spy cams in their fields to catch thieves. Does this mean scarecrows could be out of a job? From London, I'm the BBC's Sarah Stolarz for Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
It's primary day here in New York, Pennsylvania, and some nearby states. Now that Mitt Romney has all but sewn up his candidacy for president on the GOP side, he'll give a key speech today reorienting himself from the primaries and toward the general election in the fall. But as part of Marketplace's coverage of what really matters in this election, what we're calling the real economy, we have a story about an economic gulf in one primary state. By one set of measures, America's richest and America's poorest congressional districts lie just five stops apart along a New York City subway line. Let's visit.
I think there's a lot of reasons why the way the pie is divided ends up sometimes being very uneven. And this is, of course, true across the nation. It's not just New York City.
That's our tour guide, Sarah Bird Sharps. She's the co-director of the American Human Development Project that's mapped who's moving ahead and who's lagging in every part of the United States.
We might want to go to the park.
We start off on Manhattan's Upper East Side in part of Congressional District 14, the district with the highest income in the country. Here, the typical worker makes $64,000 a year. That's per person, not per household. But Bird Sharps says it isn't just about these obvious signs of wealth.
I'm just cutting down the chrysanthemums right now.
Susan Bernstein lives in this congressional district and is spending part of her day laying mulch atop a lush flower bed in Carl Schurz Park.
There are hostas and ferns and daffodils, of course.
She volunteers here one day a week. Bernstein says this park is a place where you can forget about the concrete of the surrounding city, which is why, she says, the neighborhood is very unhappy about a plan to use a garbage holding station a few blocks away.
They're going to truck garbage from all over Manhattan up to there. But there's a great group that's trying to stop this from happening. Just FYI.
New York City wants to reopen a waste transfer center that closed in the late 1990s. The neighborhood's been fighting it.
People in very affluent neighborhoods often have really sophisticated skills for making their voice heard that people in less affluent neighborhoods don't have to the same extent.
So while the island of Manhattan currently has zero waste transfer stations at work, ride the subway for about 10 minutes to the South Bronx, and it's a different story. You have 19 waste transfer stations here in Congressional District 16, the district with the lowest income in the United States. The South Bronx, among other things, is known as the asthma corridor and has one of the highest rates of hospitalization in the country, which could explain this fact.
A baby born today in the 14th district, Manhattan's east side, can expect to outlive a baby born today in this area by 4 years.
We ran into Melissa Castro and her children at a playground next to Rainey Park in the South Bronx. When Bird Sharps tells her the number of garbage transfer stations around here, Castro says she had no idea.
I think that's why all of our kids have asthma. Wow, I did not know that. Evie's daughter has to carry around with an inhaler all the time. And last summer she wasn't like that.
Researchers continue to investigate links between asthma and the transfer stations and pollution from the network of highways all around here.
I have to get out of the Bronx for my kids' health, even in schools. I don't even want to go on top of that subject.
Experts say these conditions help explain why these gaps in standards of living, just a few subway stops apart, remain so persistent.
Well, staying in New York now, it's expected that a lot of people who work on Wall Street and supported President Obama back in 2008 will be switching their support to Mitt Romney this time around. Marketplace's David Gura has our story.
As a candidate, Barack Obama wasn't just popular on Main Street. He also appealed to Wall Street.
They were concerned about change in the state of the economy, just as most of America was.
Anthony Corrado teaches government at Colby College. He says many finance types didn't like how big the federal deficit got during the Bush administration. More broadly, Obama also struck them as a unifying political figure. So as fund manager Tony Scaramucci puts it,
members of the financial community had a love affair with Barack Obama.
First they gushed, then they gave millions and millions of dollars. Even though Scaramucci is a registered Republican, he took a chance on Obama. He says he believed an Obama administration would get the economy humming again.
And it would be moderate, accommodating, compromising government.
But Scaramucci says that hasn't happened, and that love affair didn't last very long. Just a few months into his presidency, Obama said this to CBS News' 60 Minutes.
I did not run for office to be helping out a bunch of fat cat bankers on Wall Street.
That stung, and it alienated a lot of Wall Street donors. Today, Scaramucci remembers another comment Obama made about the economy.
He also said when he was running for president, if he couldn't fix the thing in 3 or 4 years, he'd be a one-termer, and so I'm determined to help him get into his retirement.
So now Scaramucci backs Mitt Romney. He's already given thousands to Romney's campaign. Political scientist Anthony Corrado says Scaramucci is not alone. Romney, who made his fortune in private equity, has a lot of friends in finance, and they don't like the way Obama has framed things.
As essentially an election against Wall Street, against millionaires, against private capital, in favor of stronger support for the middle class and what we might loosely call the 99%.
Despite that, Corrado says there are still plenty of bankers and fund managers who would be willing to support Obama again. In New York, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Now, this genre of story normally comes out of Malibu or maybe Beverly Hills, but Dateline Great Falls, Virginia, neighbors are upset that someone is building a new house they consider too fancy for what is already an upscale but leafy part of the Washington, D.C. suburbs. The Washington Post reports that Le Château de Lumière, the Castle of Light, as its owners call it, has but five bedrooms. It does, however, have some serious square footage to it, 25,400, and is apparently modeled on the Palace of Versailles. In London, media tycoon Rupert Murdoch and his son James are facing tough questions at a government hearing into news media ethics today. When they appeared together before Parliament last year, the Murdochs did not get an easy ride. One lawmaker accused them of running their media empire like the mafia. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
James Murdoch got quite a grilling when he appeared before the inquiry this morning. He was asked repeatedly why he was not aware that phone hacking was rife on one of the newspapers he was running.
I was given repeated assurances, as I've said, that these practices, that the newsroom had been investigated, that there was no evidence. I was given the same assurances as they gave outside.
Tomorrow, his father, Rupert, will be challenged on the issue of political influence, whether he had a hold over successive British governments. Tim Luckhurst is professor of journalism at Kent University. He says several British politicians will be shaking in their shoes when the elderly tycoon gives his evidence.
He's privy to information which could do real damage to the reputations of serving and former prime ministers and cabinet ministers in this country.
Other analysts say that Rupert Murdoch is totally unrepentant over the phone hacking scandal and is not happy with Prime Minister David Cameron for setting up the ethics inquiry. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
The American tourism industry relies, for the most part, on American tourists to fill up our hotels, at the national parks, at the big cities like New York and Vegas and Los Angeles. But the tourism industry is hoping its growth going forward is going to come from foreigners visiting the U.S. So the industry and the U.S. government are launching a coordinated global campaign to market the U.S. abroad. Marketplace's Bob Moon reports.
International visitors poured $153 billion into the U.S. economy last year, but Chris Perkins says we've been losing out to other countries in the decades since the 9/11 attacks. He heads marketing for the tourism partnership called Brand USA.
Our share of the international growth in tourism has been declining.
From a 17% share to less than 12% in the past decade. Some industry experts blame tougher security barriers, but Perkins suggests we just haven't been all that welcoming.
I think the biggest reason is that everybody else has been saying, hey, pick me, and they've given a clear and smart reason to do so. We've never resoundingly said you're welcome and please come.
Initially, a $12 million ad campaign will target Canada, England, and Japan using an anthem from singer-songwriter Roseanne Cash.
Mixed with that, we're sharing really, really interesting and different views of America.
The ads are being financed by contributions from the travel industry and matching funds from government fees collected from foreign travelers. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
And finally, David, you've heard of people having hot dog eating contests and pizza eating contests. Well, in Russia, they do things a little differently. They had a caviar eating contest. Now, the winner won the $326 prize, but his real prize appears to have been the $5,000 worth of luxury black caviar he had to stuff his face with in 86 seconds.
All right, I'm going to be Valoff's financial advisor. Instead of winning a $326 prize, he should have sold the caviar, and he would have made about $4,600.
Just put it in his pockets and then walked away. Exactly. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm David Brancaccio in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.